Hello, everyone. Thank you for joining us this morning. My name is Fred Appa, a training analyst for the Program Training and Consultation Center. I'll be moderating today's webinar on the evaluation of the Smoke-Free Ontario strategy. We have over 80 participants registered, and we expect that around that number will be joining us today to profile this special report on the Smoke-Free Ontario strategy. From the beginning of this calendar, CCO PTCC changed from the WebEx webinar technology to Microsoft Link. So it's good for us to take a few moments to familiarize everyone with our webinar application. This will ensure that everything goes on smoothly and you are able to view and participate in this webinar as much as possible. Honestly, this is the first time I'm moderating a webinar with the Microsoft Link, so please bear with us if we encounter any technical encumbrances. If you are having trouble logging on to the webinar via Microsoft Link, please call the 1-800 number for PTCC. The number is 1-800-363-7822. We also have a backup version of the slide presentation via the PTCC website. So please go to our website and you will find the presentation deck in PDF, and you can use the backup presentation deck to follow along with our webinar today. And lastly, I just like to inform everyone that we are currently recording this webinar, and we'll be posting the webinar on our website in approximately 1 week. Yes, let me change slides now. Many of you who are logged onto the webinar today, you will see the presentation on your right. On your left side of the screen will be a chat box. This chat box is made public to everyone, so whatever you write will be posted and viewable by all those in the webinar, as well as me and our presenters. Feel free to enter any questions in this box during the Q&A sessions at the end of each presentation. We will try to answer a good variety, but may not be able to get through all questions due to time constraints. Let me go to introductions now, and I'd like to introduce our first presenter. Dr. Robert Schwartz is the Executive Director of OTRU and Associate Professor in the Dalhousie School of Public Health at the University of Toronto. Dr. Schwartz is the Editor-in-Chief of the Canadian Journal of Program Evaluation and Principal Investigator for the Canadian Institute of Health Research, the CIHR Strategic Training Program in Public Health Policy. At OTRU, Dr. Schwartz directs a comprehensive evaluation and monitoring program, which includes surveillance, monitoring, evaluation, and performance measurement and evaluation support, as well as quality assurance. He has published widely about accountability, public health policy, program evaluation, and government third sector relations. Our second speaker presenter is Dr. Sean O'Connor, who is a recognized expert in the monitoring and surveillance of tobacco control outcomes. Sean has led the development of innovative web-based data portals designed to enhance the use and adoption of risk factor indicators by public health stakeholders. In recent years, Sean's research has focused on the cigarette pack as a communication vehicle, with an emphasis on exploring package design elements that connote perceived strength and lifestyle messaging, including gender and luxury. So, at this point, I will hand over to Dr. Schwartz to begin the presentation.
Thank you very much. And it's my pleasure to be here today with everybody. It's a strange kind of system. Those of you who know me know that I'd like to interact and look at people's faces and ask questions. So we'll be able to do less of that today. But hello to all of those who I know, and welcome to those who I don't know yet. It's really our pleasure to be here today with you. And we've got 98 slides on this thing. But these are our slides in a new fashion, where we have pictures and a few words. So don't get scared. What I'm going to do right now is take you through some of the things that give you context for the report. And then when we get into the report, we're going to start at the back. We're going to start with the punchlines, so that you don't have to wait until an hour and a half is over before you know what the main findings are. Before that, a little bit of context. This is an annual strategy evaluation report. We at OTRUE have been producing this report for some 19 years now. It's changed names, though. It used to be called the Monitoring Report, and now we're calling it the Strategy Evaluation Report. We will be this report gets released every year in late fall. So this webinar is a bit late in coming, and in the coming year, I hope that we'll actually do it in November, so that you'll have the results out soon off. So let's jump in give you some of the key findings right off the bat. I guess you're going to have to, this one, or is it the left hand?
Right.
There we go. Okay, well, we're going to start with the problem. Despite what some of you may have heard from the federal Minister of Health, and as she was explaining the cuts in the federal tobacco control strategy, tobacco is still a major problem in Canada and in Ontario. So this slide tells us that 22% of all Ontarians have used some form of tobacco in the past month. That's a higher number than you'll be used to, because this is all tobacco use. It includes chew and spit and e-cigarettes and cigarillos to the extent that they're there. Sean, constantly my quality control is saying, no, it doesn't include e-cigarettes. We don't have data on e-cigarettes. Sorry for that little slip. That's a major problem. Over a fifth of our population is still using this stuff. And for cigarettes, 18% of Ontarians 12 plus are still past 30-day current smokers. So that is still a very high number. And just to contextualize that a bit, it's gone down, as you can see in the figure. It's gone down from 2000, when it was around 23%, down to about 18% in 2009, which was the last year that we had data at this point, 2009-10. So, you know, that's an accomplishment to an extent, but it's not a very rapid rate of decline. So, you know, this suggests that there's a whole lot more that needs to be done. Because I don't have to explain to everybody on here, having that many people smoking is a huge burden on the health of the population and on the economy. What explains the fact that we haven't made greater accomplishments? And I don't want anybody to get this wrong. There are accomplishments. Ontario has one of the most progressive tobacco control strategies in the world, certainly in Canada, and certainly in North America. Nevertheless, what we found in this strategy evaluation report is that there are some gaps that require attention. Some of these we know are being attended to by the decision makers at the local level and at the provincial level. But we just want to highlight what we found in this report as in need of improvement. Social marketing, which is the term of the day for public education, the mass media, etc., is there, but it's not there in the dose or in the duration that is deemed necessary by the best scientific evidence. Not recognizing that there are really good efforts going on, the investments have not been made in the past few years, I would say, to bring this key component up to the level that's necessary to bring about greater change. Australia, for example, has invested tremendously in this area, and they've had a lot more success than we have to date so far in Ontario. The cessation system is something that gets spoken about frequently. Everybody knows for years now we've had report after report after report saying that we need a stronger, a better cessation system. But it's not there yet, and that's recognized in the data that we'll be showing you shortly about what's happening in cessation. As we all know, tax is the single most effective measure for decreasing rates of smoking, and in Ontario we have unfortunately not had a major change in the taxation on cigarettes in quite some time. In the area of initiation of cigarette smoking amongst youth and young adults, there has been headway. Undoubtedly, the rates of smoking for children, for students in school-age children up to the end of grade 12 has gone down significantly and substantially, and you'll see in the slides later on it's about 9% now. However, it's still at 9% for those leaving high school, and then once they get into college or workplace settings or universities afterwards, we're still up in the mid-20 percentages. So there's still a lot of prevention work that that needs to be done. In the Scientific Advisory Committee report, the recommendation was very clearly on the need for greater prevention efforts for high-risk youth or high-risk communities or high-risk schools, depending on how you want to define it, and we still don't see a whole lot of that going on. Availability is another problem area that the Scientific Advisory Committee report noted very strongly lacks very little happening in that area, either at the provincial or at the local levels. Tobacco products still available at practically every corner store, and more needs to be done if we want to solve our problem. Finally, a new term that was coined in the Scientific Advisory Committee report, social exposure, is something that we're looking at more closely. People, including kids, still see cigarettes and tobacco products being used constantly, outdoors, in movies, on the computer, around schools, at doorways, on patios, on beaches. So there is work that's moving forward in this area. More needs to be done. How are you feeling now? That was a really cheerful way to start this presentation off, but it also, I mean, it just is a way, I think, to motivate us all to keep at it and to look particularly at the gaps that we have moving forward. Now, I want to say a few words about OTRU's role in all of this. So OTRU was set up as an arm's length organization that's able to provide this kind of critical perspective on where we are in the strategy. So it's our role to do all those things that are listed on the slide, and you can just take a second and read through them. The important thing I want to focus on is that this is arm's length. So we do this independently. We're based at a university, and we're able to provide all the stakeholders with this information, which is meant to help people focus their efforts moving forward and advocate for more work to be done in those areas that are weak. For those of you who don't know, just very quickly, we provide service to the general tobacco control community in Ontario, and these are some of the ways that we do it: through our online course, through our tremendous library services, which have a magic search capacity, highly advised, through our OTRU directory, which puts you in touch with experts in various areas in the field as needed, and through our TIMS Tobacco Informatics Monitoring System, which brings data to your fingertips, and Sean will say a few words about that as we move forward. What's the context for evaluating the strategy? A strategy evaluation is something that is a very, very challenging undertaking. Because, you know, we've already presented with a few pieces of data about what's happening at the population level. And we know that the strategy is made up of many, many different components, which each of which is somehow supposed to bring about change at the population level. The challenge is trying to attribute the change at the population level to each of those components. What effect does each component have on the overall picture? And how do those components interact in some synergistic way to bring about the maximum change? It, added to that is the complicatedness of this of a strategy, which involves multiple operators or organizations or public health units, NGOs, who are operating interventions, which are policy interventions, program interventions, and media interventions of different shapes and sizes, aimed often at one of the three major program areas, and sometimes at more than one of the three program areas. So trying to make sense of this is a challenge. I have to say that we haven't completely made complete sense of it. We've made progress in our approaches and methods, and as we move forward, we have some suggestions at the end of this and some directions we're already taking to further improve the sophistication of our strategy evaluation. One thing I want to say and make very clear up front, one of the weaknesses that we are aware of is that we don't know a sufficient amount about what is happening at the local level. To the extent that we have data available, it's been taken into account in our evaluation of the strategy. It comes through in the results, certainly in the areas of prevention, around youth engagement, for example, around youth access, for example, tobacco-free sports and recreation, around protection. But there isn't complete data here on everything that's happening at the public health unit level. We have a way to help move that forward in the coming year, and we'll hope that we have a lot of cooperation from everybody out there for everybody's benefit. And the other limitation of the population level surveys is that for many of the indicators, there isn't sufficient sample size at the public health unit level in order to provide the data in a way that can show significant change over time. So that's something we just want to keep in mind as we move forward. So how do you evaluate this complex strategy? Well, it requires a comprehensive and a complex evaluation approach. And, you know, the way that we do that is that fortunately, the people who designed the smoke-free Ontario strategy, moving back a number of years, thought about this ahead of time and have provided, you know, reasonable amount of resources in order to enable evaluation and monitoring efforts that provides a good deal of evaluative information that makes a reasoned strategy evaluation report possible. We work at the micro, the meso, and the macro levels, going all the way down to individual programs at the provincial and sometimes at the local levels. We have a capacity to help people do their evaluation work at the local level, and many of you are taking that up. Then at the meso level, we do sub-strategy evaluations, we do cluster evaluations, for example, the Youth Engagement Initiative, Then we have our macro-level work, which involves the survey work, largely, that we're going to talk about. Of course, none of this makes any sense without knowledge exchange, which is bidirectional. Our key, our knowledge exchange advisory group process, which has been a major addition to the knowledge exchange activities that we had already undergone. And indeed, this webinar is a further example of how we are doing that, and we have plans this year to do at least 5 webinars in the field and to engage the communities in addition. We're not going to spend a lot of time. The next 3 slides just give you a sense of some of the things that we're doing. Because this is also part of knowledge exchange. It's important that the field be aware of the studies that we have underway. So these lists are things that we're doing now, and I've got them organized by prevention, cessation, and protection. And just so you know, these are most of these are underway and just about completed. Some of the reports are out, and some of the other reports are on their way out, and we'll get to you in various formats for knowledge exchange, including future webinars. And then we have a whole slew of new projects that we're just in the process of agreeing. Some of those have come out from up from suggestions from public health units and TCANs and other partners in the strategy about what they need help with and what they think are the important things to do moving forward. And we are just about finalized our work plan for this year, and we will convey that to the field shortly. These are the cessation projects that we've been working on the past year or two. Just to focus on the last one, the Ontario Tobacco Survey analyses. The Ontario Tobacco Survey is our longitudinal survey, and each year we do somewhere between 10 and 15 studies that are giving us a really good sense of what's happening to people over the history of their attempts to quit. What services are they using, with what effects, et cetera. And that's one of the things that we need to be doing better this year is to exchange that knowledge with the field in a better way. Because that stuff has been published largely in peer-reviewed journals, and we don't always let you know what we found. We'll be doing more of that. And these are the protection process that we have been working on. The last one, the third-hand smoke expert panel, is something that you've received invitation to a webinar that's happening in June, May or June. So that's an exciting new project on what do we know, what's the best evidence about third-hand smoke. These are some of our other projects at the more general level, and I'm not going to go into that right now. Okay, now we get to the focus of this session, which is the strategy evaluation report. There's a picture of it. It can be downloaded through a PDF on our website, www.otru.org. There's a link to it right on our homepage. So if you haven't looked at it until now, that's the place to find it. This is the table of contents. So as you can see, we start off with the general picture at the macro level of tobacco use. We have a chapter each on protection, cessation, and prevention. And the concluding note draws out the strengths and those gaps that I've already showed you. Why are we doing this? This isn't an audit report. So it's not just sort of a accountability measure. Indeed, it's not part of the accountability frameworks of the government. The Ministry of Health and Long-Term Care has its own accountabilities, and it has its own way of monitoring what's happening in the strategy. This feeds into that, but this is not that. The purpose of this report is learning. It's to help us know what is working, what is missing, how can we improve the things that need to be improved and can be improved. That's the sole purpose of the report, and people may have heard me argue in other places that ought to be whatever any accountability report is for also, but this report even more so is not designed to put a piece of paper or a large number of pieces of paper on anybody's desk. It's designed to be used by policymakers. Indeed, in the task forces at the provincial level, it's been discussed, the findings have been discussed quite intensively. And we hope that it will be as useful for people at the local level. I just wanted to run through our conceptual approach briefly. So we do use logic models, but these are logic models of a different sort. These are what we call intervention path logic models. And you'll see these, I know you're not meant to actually be able to read these, so this isn't an eye test, a vision test. This is just to give you a picture of what these logic models actually look like. And you can find them in the report itself if you happen to have that open in front of you, or you can go to it after the webinar. The conceptual approach is to focus on the interventions, and that's that second column to the left, from the left-hand side, which gives a list of all of the things that may affect each of the goal areas. So there's a separate logic model for protection, prevention, and cessation. Each of them on the far right-hand side has the long-term outcomes. So for cessation, for example, the proportion of people who quit is one of our outcomes. And then we try to figure out what is the contribution of each of the interventions through some key paths to achieving those. And we're going to show you how that happens in some of the slides later on. Just for reference, on the far left, we have the infrastructure, which are things like PTCC and OTRU, the things that enable the interventions to happen. So that's how we define them in this approach, is that in order for all those interventions to happen, you need the technical assistance and the training, you need the research and evaluation support, you need the leadership, you need the coordination. So all of those things are the infrastructure, and we actually don't focus on that too much in this report, but it's certainly something that requires some attention. This slide shows you the basic outline of the path logic model. It starts with your inputs which are basically your interventions. It goes through the strategic components, which are the path and the paths, which we'll describe for each of the goal areas shortly. And then it goes through your short, intermediate, and long term. Here are the paths that are key intermediaries on the way to achieving the long-term outcomes. These are evidence-informed, and we've described for each of those logic models four or five different pathways to achieving the long-term outcomes. So one of the ones that comes across at least two is social climate. Which is something people have talked about a lot. You need to change the social climate in order to reduce the use of tobacco. So how normative is it, how acceptable is it for people to be smoking tobacco when you go to a party inside, when you go to a party outside, for example? We need to change the level of acceptability of these things in order for us to bring about the long-term effect. But how do you do that? And so certainly many of the interventions that we have, the media interventions, for example, the youth engagement interventions, for example, restrictions on advertising, for sure, are designed to have an effect on the social climate. And that's one of the things that we look at. That's just an example. You can see the other pathways here, and I don't think that we have time to go through each of them. The methodological approach that we have involves, at the macro level, making use of all of the population surveys that are available to us. So if people don't know the acronyms, Canadian Community Health Survey, Canadian Tobacco Use Monitoring Survey, Youth Smoking Survey, Center for Addiction and Mental Health Monitor, and the Ontario Student Drug Use and Health Survey. That was a mouthful. So we look at this in different ways, using populations that are differentiated by gender, by occupation, by marital status, by geography, and the piggy bank is eaten. Sean has a major season on this one. What's important in a strategy evaluation report, which is repeated over year by year, is to get trends. We don't give you just a snapshot of the past year. We see, well, how is the past year, what's happened over the past year that shows an improvement or not over previous years. And then because we all know that year-over-year change is difficult to achieve, we need to look at longer-term trends, and we go back 10 years and more in some instances. This is, I've already said, the question of the extent to which local context is taken into account, and some of the constraints that we have had in doing this, where the data exists, we do put it in. In the coming year, we're going to try and get more of it, and we can talk more about that later. I've been talking about this until now as if there's some sort of regression analysis that you can do, which will tell you what's the contribution of each intervention to the overall change in smoking prevalence, for example. It ain't that simple, unfortunately. The biostatisticians and the epidemiologists might want for that to be the case, but it doesn't really work that way. And for that reason, we engage in what we call contribution analysis. We tell the best story possible based on the evidence that we have, which is not conclusive. We can't actually tell you precisely what proportion of the change in smoking prevalence is the result of youth engagement versus smokers' helpline versus tobacco-free sports and recreation. But through the data that we have on REACH, through the evaluative information we have from program evaluations, and through our population surveys and through additional interviews, we're able to tell a story which is out there for people to validate or to refute as possible. Okay, so that was a very long introduction, we have given you the punchlines. We've given you some results already, and at this point, I'm going to ask Sean to take over a bit as my mouth is dry, and we did plan, actually, as I'm being reminded, to pause right here and see if there are some questions and comments. And we have one that has just been passed to me, and it says, can we see the percentages expressed as numbers of people? As we saw with Luke's comments this week, downward trending percentages here the raw numbers of people who still smoke. Yes, certainly we can provide that data. Indeed, that data exists in TIMS, our Tobacco Informatics Monitoring System, we do relate to that in some of the reports that we have done recently. And if people have specific needs about this, then please let us know and we'll provide that specific information. Are there any other questions and comments? Not at this point. Okay, so let's move on to cessation.
Great. So just following the kind of outline that Rob presented up front, we're going to spend a few minutes looking at some macro indicators, population-level indicators of cessation, before we move on to kind of the micro-meso, kind of the contribution of various programs, policies, and services with respect to the cessation goal. So with that, actually, we're just going to switch over a computer, I guess, maybe. So just give me one sec. We're just going to shuffle some chairs here. Great. Okay. So as this is kind of a breakdown of the cessation table of contents. So in the actual reports, we do kind of give an overview of what the cessation strategy looks like in Ontario, focusing on kind of what infrastructure is there and what interventions and programs and services are there. We follow that by providing these macro-level outcomes, which we're going to get to a few of them right now. And then we go on to try to wrap it up. Okay, well, what are the contributions of the various programs to achieving these outcomes? So we have this logic model that folks will be familiar with by now. It does take place within a larger social context that can impact the cessation initiatives, including pro-tobacco influences. But with respect to indicators of success, We're going to start off with this notion of the annualized quit rate. So how are we doing in Ontario? You know, what this top line is showing is that in the past year, 7% of folks in Ontario have quit for at least, you know, at some point for at least 30 days. So that's in contrast to the number of people in Ontario that have actually quit. So past year smokers have actually quit for one solid year. So one solid year is a fairly good measure of sustained abstinence from cigarettes. So we see 1% of smokers have achieved that rate. I mean, this is comparable with other jurisdictions, but it is quite low. What this suggests is if we do want to drop our prevalence, the smoking prevalence of cigarettes, for instance, was 18%, we really need to get these quit rates up. It's also the smoking rate of 18% is informed by these quit rates. It's also informed by the uptake of cigarettes of youth, which we'll get to when we talk about prevention as well. So in terms of the trajectory of folks making a successful quit, one of the one model has it that so you obviously what is of kind of the process of moving towards a successful quit is you need quit intentions. So we see here 6-month quit intentions and 30-day quit intentions. So this you're asking the population, do you intend to quit in the next 6 months? Do you intend to quit in the next 30 days? And we see these are relatively flat over time, which is the bad news. The good news, though, is that half of all smokers have identified that they want to quit in the next 6 months, and indeed 25% want to quit in the next 30 days. So, you know, from a social marketing point of view, that's not bad news. You've got a lot of potential, you know, customers, clients, at-need people out there that they've expressed a desire that they do want to quit. So what is this? How does this translate into folks actually making a quit attempt in the past year? So when you ask them, you know, have you quit for 24 hours or more in the past year, we see that 41% have actually made a quit attempt. So again, whereas the previous slide suggested that half of all smokers intended to quit in the next 6 months and 25 in the next 30 days, we do see that actual people are acting on that. So their behavior is somewhat consistent with their intentions that, you know, 41% want to make a quit attempt. That's the good news. The bad news is that it has been fairly flat in recent history, right, with no increases, over time here. So what this slide is showing, again, we ask folks, the last time you visited a physician, did the physician advise you to quit smoking? And likewise, when you visit a dentist. The bad news here is that really when you're a smoker, you're going to a physician and dentist, you know, not a lot of these health professionals or, you know, there's a significant number of these health professionals that are not asking their clients or giving them advice about smoking, right? So that's the story here.
I'll just add to that. It's you know, it looks pretty encouraging when you see that 70% of physicians are asking smokers who visited a physician. 70% of smokers who visited a physician were asked by the physician and advised not to smoke. That, you know, that sounds pretty good. But then when you look at that previous slide where only 1% of smokers successfully quit for over a year, it certainly raises questions about the effectiveness of physicians asking and advising. So, you know, just... we know from the literature that a physician asking and advising is supposedly an effective measure. So it can be done. It's more effective than some other measures that we have. Obviously, something needs to happen here because what's happening in that physician's office is not working.
Yeah, and we see that, you know, for the physician, that is a significant increase over 2006 levels, but it would be great to see that that trend to continue. We see here use of behavioral or pharmaceutical leads in the province. So behavioral aids in 2009 at 13%, pharmaceutical aids at 34%. And if we look at kind of, you know, have smokers used any kind of an aid, we're at 41% as well. So this just kind of gives you a breakdown of what folks are using in their efforts to quit. So that's kind of, you know, a brief summary of kind of the process of quitting and some of the use of aids to quit. The response is kind of the part of the contribution here. Like, what's the strategy doing? So this is kind of a breakdown a little bit of the logic models. But, you know, obviously there's various, there's you know, the province has funded a number of organizations to build capacity around quitting. There's a number of tobacco control policies available or present in the province to facilitate that process. And a number of programs and services are directed towards the goal of increased quitting. We see here a selection of a number of, you know, positive vectors that are working to, you know, push trend lines down in terms of current smoking, looking to push quitting behavior up. This is counteracted, of course, by, you know, pro-tobacco influences, which may have influence over price, packaging, which may influence purchase behaviors and so forth. As Rob suggested earlier, there's a number of pathways to quitting. So when we consider how well we're doing in Ontario, we look at these paths in terms of, you know, are we increasing knowledge or an awareness? Are we creating a social, a positive social climate? Are we decreasing access and availability and increasing smoke-free settings? So these aren't all the pathways, but these are just some high-level pathways which we feel and the evidence suggests will help contribute to the short, intermediate, and long-term goals of the cessation system. So in terms of the contribution of the interventions, what the report looks at is it looks at the reach and some of the effects of the programs and services of the various funded projects in Ontario, which those are the ones suggested by the previous slides that listed or showed images of the various projects. So the report actually has sections on each of these various projects here listed on the left-hand side. For our purposes, we're just, for this presentation, we're just kind of rolling them all up just to give people a general sense of what's in the report. That, you know, we've looked at the various reach of these programs. The caveat is, of course, these are dealing with different populations. Some are, you know, more hardcore smokers than others, for instance. So the purpose isn't to compare these prevention efforts in terms of, well, look, you know, this program has a higher reach than the other program. That's not necessarily the purpose. Again, if you're dealing with different populations, you would expect to obtain different reaches and have different successes in terms of the effects. So just as a kind of a general overview, as we mentioned, 7% of Ontarians have quit at some time in the past, for 30 days or more in the past year. But the way we got the 1% in terms of successful quitting is the fact that of these 7.3%, 83% are going to relapse, right? Relapse rate is high, and that's why we're left with only 1% successfully quitting for one or more years. Overall, we see that the interventions are reaching approximately 5% of smokers annually. Given that we know that only, you know, 1% are being successful in their quit attempts, there's room for improvements and greater success within the cessation strategy. Just kind of to contextualize some of the gaps that Rob had mentioned earlier, you know, what can we do to achieve the cessation goals? Well, what we're suggesting is that we a social marketing campaign that's intensive occurs with intensity level that is happening throughout the year can help us reach these goals. The there hasn't really been much of a tax increase since 2006. I think there may have been one since that. So, you know, tax is a known tool to increase cessation availability. You know, the point of sale display ban did decrease the visible presence of smoking, but there are still cigarettes available in every corner. So that's something to look at. And, you know, we need a sustained and complex cessation system. Every smoker should know how to get help and should have that help available to them in their community. So we've got some time here for a few questions. I see we've got a couple of questions on the board. So we're just going to take a minute to collect our thoughts and read these questions and respond.
All right, so I can start responding to the first question. Thank you for asking. Obviously, the point that's being made is that what is being done in the physician's office is certainly not enough to bring about the cessation rates that we need. Had we seen high cessation rates, we would have been happier. The point is that more or something different needs to be happening in and out of the physician's office in order for a greater change to occur. Regarding the driven to quit comment, what we try to do is just to make sure that we put on paper everything that's going out that is promoting cessation, and to broaden, you know, as much as possible, give people a sense of here's all the activity that is happening. People are being enriched in some way, shape, or form to encourage them to stop smoking. And that's why it's in there. But certainly, as Sean mentioned, each of those programs needs to be considered individually to understand what we mean by the reach behind that program. Leave the Pack Behind is another example of that. It's got some 20,000 people reached for something, but most of those are not being reached to make them stop smoking specifically. I wonder if people have any thoughts or questions about the gaps that we pointed out and if these are resonating with the people in the field you know, whether are we getting this right and are there things that are being done out there? I know there's lots going out. Well, there's a fair bit going on in cessation that isn't yet captured in this report, something we hope to do in the future. But we'd like to know about, you know, whether there are additional things that we need to be considering when we're looking at what's happening in cessation.
All the lines are muted now, so if you want to unmute, you just press star 7 to unmute.
Rob, it's Michael Perley.
Hi, Michael.
Just one point. I'm not sure how to factor this in, but I think the sense a lot of us have, of course, is that contraband is maybe undermining is not precisely the right word, but it's certainly affecting quit rates given the sensitivity of particularly the younger cohorts to price. How do we factor in the presence of contraband as a determinant of how well or not well the cessation system or the components that are now out there are working? How do we determine what the impact of contraband is?
Yeah, it's a good question, and it's difficult to calculate a precise mathematical answer to it. What we do in the report is we note that contraband is part of those sort of what we call the pro tobacco forces that are working against the interventions that are going on here without being able to quantify. Having said that, you know, we have you know, the data on the reach and the effectiveness of, for example, the cessation program. We know how many people are using smokers alcohol, we know how many people are using stock, etc. And we know what their quit rates are, so we're able to have a sense of the effects of those programs. Would those programs be more effective Were there no contraband? Undoubtedly. By how much? We don't know.
Okay, fair enough. I know it's difficult. I'm just we're of course struggling with that as well here and elsewhere. But so we've got less than 5% of smokers involved specifically in a given program, some of which are not real, as Suzanne pointed out, not real cessation programs. They're not that they don't contribute. They have absolutely contribute, but they're not actual delivery of cessation services. They're encouragements of people to get into the system where cessation services can be delivered to them. So if we've only got that number of people trying, what would you say is the major... Can you rank order what's missing or what needs to be done in any way?
Yeah, well, I think that we need to work on all of the components. But the first thing is to increase intentions to quit, which, as Sean showed in this slide, has been pretty flat.
Mm-hmm.
If more people aren't intending to quit, especially within the next 30 days, then they're not going to move on to making a quit attempt. Previous work that we did has demonstrated that even those who have an intention to quit are not accessing services sufficiently. So that needs to be done as well. But as I think you would agree, Michael, what we need to do is change the environment to make it more easier for people to quit, harder to obtain cigarettes by increasing price, by decreasing the places where people can smoke, by decreasing the social acceptability, by decreasing the availability, by decreasing the marketing. So, you know, in Ontario, we've done a lot in those areas, but not sufficient.
Mm-hmm.
You know, offering more cessation services to those who require them to actually get them to quit is the component that needs still more work, because the system isn't working as a system. Everybody's referring to everybody else. Nobody's actually providing the service. I'm exaggerating when I said that. But that is certainly one of the problems that we have. And then the whole area of relapse prevention is something that is barely being touched by any of the services. Now, if you get people to quit for a day, you get them to quit for a week, you get them to quit for a month, but the relapse rate is 83%. More needs to be done to engage smokers for the longer term, encouraging them to stay quit, or if they do last, to stay strong and to stay smoke-free.
So really what these numbers, if I read them correctly, and I may not be, but if I read them correctly, the period that has seen the implementation of the Smoke-Free Ontario strategy from the time the Liberals were elected in 2003 through to 2009, during that period, while there have been a lot of advances, there has not been any. That has not been, those advances have not been accompanied by a corresponding increase in the number of people who actually quit smoking. It's remained flat during that particular period. So does that tell us? I don't know what that tells us. I haven't a clue. Maybe it doesn't tell us anything. Maybe it just says we need to do more work. But I'm trying to figure out what that's telling me. It's not, because a lot of the Smoke Free Ontario strategy, many of the components were not designed to make people quit smoking. It was hoped that smoke-free spaces would lead to more people quitting, increasing their intentions, etc., because of increasing difficulty to smoke in various environments, and the display ban would decrease triggering and relapse and so on.
We want to give a chance to address some of the other questions as well, but just a quick response to that is that it's not that there hasn't been any progress. There has been some progress, and as you know, contraband may be causing less progress than we want, but there are missing elements in the strategy.
Right.
You know, the marketing, the social marketing is one of those.
Right.
And having a more comprehensive and systematic cessation system is another. So it's not completely black picture, but more needs to be done. So should we go on and address some of the other questions?
Sure, yeah. So there was one question here, were natural quit rates accounted for in the one-year cessation rates? And yeah, there all the quit rates that were presented were in response to asking participants, did you quit? So we don't know what method they used to quit. It would have been the whole gamut of cold turkey to, you know, any of the programs or services or medical interventions or whatever else. We just asked their behavior like that. So another question was just asking about social marketing and explain the potential influence of social marketing, and do you mean increased awareness of cessation support? But we're using the term social marketing to be quite broad. It may be mass media campaigns, which may have different goals. The goals of mass media campaigns may be to drive people to cessation services, to raise awareness of cessation services. It may be to increase knowledge, knowledge of the harmful effects of cigarettes, maybe directed towards adults, maybe directed towards youth, maybe, you know, changing the social climate. There can be a whole mix of goals for social marketing, and it's not limited to mass media. It's just, you know, any form of communication that has goals of rather knowledge, attitudes, and behaviors, right? That does not necessarily limit to cessation per se. It obviously we're suggesting that the whole strategy, the whole smoke-free Ontario strategy, needs intensive, both in terms of duration, social marketing. And so we'll let the there's a nice conversation going on about programs and services and cessation strategies. We'll just let that play out online. At this point, it's great. I mean, I think that there's a fair amount of consensus. I think if you look at the whole thread there.
I'll just address that question about holding the hand of every quitter. Why doesn't public health just use population approaches? It's got to be a mixture. Population approaches are going to work for many people much of the time, but because use of tobacco is a serious addiction, there are many people who are going to require some clinical level intervention. Whose role that is, you know, public health or the hospital or the physician, is something that can be discussed.
Yeah. There is questions around cessation in youth. By all means, I think everybody recognizes the value of getting youth to quit smoking. Just to contextualize that a little bit, people in grade 7, 8, they're not really current smokers. It's not really measurable whether they, you know, smoked in the past 30 days. The smoking rates in grade 9 kind of, you know, jump up to about 2%, grade 10, 6%, grade 11 and 12, you know, 9%. So it's getting up there in grade 11 and 12 as you get older. There's people are moving from lifetime abstinence to experimentation. They're smoking one cigarette, 10, 20, 30, 99 cigarettes type of thing. So they may, there's a number of strategies that can be directed toward them. There's still kind of, there's prevention strategies when you're in that kind of experimentation phase. Whether you call it prevention or cessation, you know, I think there needs to be contextual programs to address those folks as well.
And Nathan, we are working on with you on the youth cessation, and OTRU's offered its support to that project.
Yeah. I mean, what the discourse here on the questions is suggesting is that there's some debates going on around cessation, some debates going on around youth prevention and cessation. It's great to see, and it suggests that this isn't the right venue for this because it doesn't facilitate the discourse around this, but it's great to see the participants on the call just kind of addressing comments back and forth. I don't know to what extent we can capture all these questions, but we can potentially just circulate these, and OTRU will be looking at these questions and kind of doing an analysis of these questions to find out can we identify some gaps of knowledge and can address this at some point in the future. So with that, I think I'm going to move on.
To prevention now.
Yeah. So moving to the to prevention goal, if folks have a burning question that didn't get answered, they can, you know, re-ask it. And because I'm getting passed notes to some of these questions, I can always get a note passed back to me. You can try it again if you really want to get it on the agenda. So in terms of youth prevention, we have a chapter on youth prevention. Again, it discusses the infrastructure and the interventions that we are aware of in the strategy. Then it moves into some macro-level surveillance of long- and short-term outcomes for prevention. And then it moves on to, you know, the policies and programs that are available. What to the extent that we can kind of look at the contributions of these policies, you know, these policies or programs to the overall goals. Much more challenging for us to do that within prevention because we don't have access to the data or the programs. Either the, you know, we don't have access to the data or the data is not amenable to quantifying the contributions. Not to say that you need quantitative data to do that. So qualitative research or evaluation can also make a case for the contributions. So again, there is a logic model for prevention that is in the report, and again, these logic models have rolled through a history of logic models within the province. So indicators of success. So, you know, what we see here is that, you know, lifetime abstinence is quite high in grade 7. As you get older, as one might suspect, it does decrease. So we see here in grade 12, 58% of people are only abstinent. Past year initiation is one indicator of kind of people uptaking, you know, the use of cigarettes. So uptake is quite low in the younger grades. We see it's 4% in grade 9, and it moves in terms of the number of students in grades 10 and 12. You know, who started smoking in the, who started to experiment in the last year, right? 8 to 9% of kids. This last finding isn't in the report, but we thought we'd throw it out here, and we just kind of actually calculated this the last couple of days. So amongst 25 to 29-year-olds, you know, smokers who have ever experimented, so they've tried one or more cigarettes in their lifetime. They may be current smokers. They may have only smoked 2 or 3 cigarettes in their lifetime. Amongst all that group of people, 73% of them would have went on to be an ever smoker. That is, at some point in their life, they would have smoked, you know, 100 cigarettes, you know, or more. So we do see that that if you're going to experiment, there's a good chance that you're going to go on to actually take up smoking. This slide here does suggest that amongst some of the grades, most notably grade 9 and grade 12, there is some declines in current smoking, you know, smoking in the past 30 days, which is kind of the standard measure we use for whether or not someone is currently smoking. Like that. So the declines are from 2000 to 2009. So that's quite a large band of time, right? 6 years. So we'd like to see that to move down for some of these older grades, particularly grade 11 and grade 12, right, where it's 9%. Current smoking young adults. So we're moving up the age a little bit here in terms of 18 to 19, 20 to 24, and 25 to 29. And what the data here is telling us, again, that there are some, you know, some general downward declines over time from 2000 to 2009. Right? So some good news. Again, overall the rates are quite high. If we look at the rates of 25 to 29-year-olds, it's 26% here in 2009. We don't break it down here by sex, but if we were to break that down by sex, males would be significantly higher than females. Ease of obtaining cigarettes. So if you're a smoker, you think, you know, you believe it's quite easy to obtain cigarettes, right? So whether you're getting them yourself or from retail or through social sources, if you want to smoke, you can smoke. Among non-smokers, half believed it was easy. So non-smokers still have that notion that access or availability is perhaps tough. So that kind of just, you know, those slides, you know, in the report we have a number of other indicators that are long-term and short-term. That was just meant to give you a sense of the burden of tobacco and you know, the rate of uptake amongst youth. So the response is really the part of the strategy that addresses prevention goals, right? So there's a number of infrastructure and there's a number of interventions. Interventions include policy and programs and services that are being run. There's a sample of these provided here. This is not exclusive. A number of these, again, thinking of kind of positive and negative vectors, there's a number of positive vectors that are trying to push current smoking down, trying to push uptake down, but recognizing that there's a number of vectors out there, pro-tobacco influences, that are trying to, you know, that in effect push smoking rates up, right? So this could be smoking in the movies, It could be, fighting tax increases, fighting legislation around smoking in patios or whatever else. So the paths that have been identified to prevention, right, is limiting social exposure to tobacco. This is related in part to social climate. You don't want youth to see people smoking. You want to denormalize the tobacco industry, but you want to change the social norm of smoking as well. Access and availability, which was suggested by the beliefs about ease of access, is another path. We want to increase knowledge of their harmful effects. We want every kid to kind of know, smoking is an issue. If you start smoking, even if it's, 1, 10, 20, 50 cigarettes, that you're on the trajectory to uptaking smoking. We also want to increase the resiliency of youth to make choices to resist tobacco. So the approach here, again, in the report, ideally, is to look at the reach and the effect of the programs and policies. We don't always have access. In this report, we didn't always have access to solid data to do a full contribution analysis. But we've laid the framework so that we can do that in the future. And by engaging with folks on the call and others in the field, we look to do increasingly more sophisticated job in the years to come with this approach. So here is a conceptual model. It's from the CDC of youth engagement. So this is a little bit of a case study on youth engagement. I'm going to pass it over to Rob to kind of pick this part of the presentation up speak to this slide and more so the next couple of slides, which is, I guess, just a case study on youth engagement in the province.
Okay, so what we want to do is just provide a bit of a case study about how we look at individual interventions how they help us understand what's happening in the strategy. So when the youth engagement initiative and part of the whole youth engagement strategy was being developed at the ministry, they asked for our involvement, and we've come on and are involved in a formative evaluation of youth engagement. The idea is that by engaging youth, have effects not only on those youth who are directly engaged in the program, but you also have, and they in turn have an effect on the communities that surround them. They advocate for some policy change. They can bring about changes in social norms amongst their peers. And the idea is that eventually you can actually attribute changes in initiation and use of tobacco amongst youth to youth engagement. But this is tremendously challenging, especially when a program is in its initial stages, is vaguely defined, and has limited dosage and reach. If we can just move on to the next slide, thank you. This is sort of the package of youth engagement-related initiatives that we know of that are currently in the field. There's the youth engagement initiative itself, where the YECs are funded. There's the YADI, Tobacco Free Sports and Recreation, Smoke Free Movies, and Action Week primarily. Basically what we're trying to do in all of these is to build knowledge and resilience. The approach that we've taken to evaluating youth engagement is a cluster evaluation approach. OTRA doesn't have the capacity, nor should it be the case, that it goes out and evaluates everything that's happening in youth engagement in every public health unit. Nor can we do that for other initiatives. So what we've done is devise a strategy, and this is a completely collaborative evaluation with people on the steering committee from public health units, from TCANs, from the ministry, from other experts, et cetera. And the idea is that we support evaluation efforts that are going on at the local level. We develop a sort of toolkit of common tools for evaluating. And we also are conducting a number of case studies in order to bring about some information that's useful for all. So the idea is to generate some cross-learning. We've been involved together with YADI in talking about this at two occasions where people come in for training, and there is more of that planned. The challenge, of course, is to be able to demonstrate that these youth engagement initiatives are having any effect in their community. And what we have said so far is that it's way too early on to go to that stage. What we need to look at is more proximate output and outcome indicators show us, well, what is the advocacy that's happening? What's the policy advocacy that's happening as a result of youth engagement? How many people are being engaged and reached through the various youth engagement initiatives? And then to start collecting perceptions about the potential changes that these may be having. Nobody should be trying to say, we've put in a youth engagement coordinator and we've engaged directly 15 youth, and therefore we're going to see significant drops in initiation. Those kinds of direct relationships are not possible, certainly not at this point in time, and with the dosage and duration of the intervention to date. So just to summarize a little bit, the prevention section of the report, initiation is still an issue. Experimentation is happening, not to a small extent. So by the time people are out of high school, our more recent data and literature review demonstrate a significantly high correlation between experimenting and becoming an established smoker, the access to cigarettes is still high despite everything that we've done to prevent sales to minors. We know that even if 10% or 15% of stores are selling, the youth know where to find them, and we know that most of their cigarettes are obtained from social sources in any case. Finally, the gaps in the strategy related to prevention, and you'll notice that many of these gaps repeat themselves because these things affect each of the goal areas: social marketing, taxes, availability, and then a sustained and comprehensive approach. School-based program, and we know the ministry is working on improving a lot of these things. School-based programming. In high school youth, a very small proportion have been exposed to any tobacco control programming in the past year. As we mentioned earlier, there's a paucity of services aimed and tailored for high-risk youth or schools or communities. And in youth engagement, we put it here as a gap just because it's still in its infancy and more could be done. So we're going to pause again for questions and discussion.
So just a couple of comments, just to, underscore that this report, although released in 2012, it really is about the system that was in place in kind of 2009, 2010, a little bit of 2011. So it doesn't talk about all the initiatives that have been happening over the last year and a half potentially that are new. The report that we're preparing for now and will be released this fall will be up to date as possible. So we'll be including some of this material. We'll be looking at these comments and some of the debate that's going on, and it'll inform us about some of the debates that are happening in the field of what is cessation, what is youth engagement, and so forth. So.
I'm just seeing the comments as they pass by pretty quickly on the screen here, and most of them I agree with. I mean, I don't think there's any disagreement. There's one question there from Jennifer Robertson: do we measure the past? Not enough. We're trying, and this work has actually identified some gaps in our measurement. So, for example, social climate that I talked about earlier had not been well measured. We've now inserted some measurement on that, and we'll be able to have the data on that shortly, and it will be incorporated in the strategy evaluation report in coming years. You're going too fast for me to...
I think we're going to just let the discourse kind of play out online. We're just kind of monitoring reading it, so just give us a moment here.
Fred or Eric, are you seeing any that are jumping out at you that... we might address?
Yeah, I think I've been looking at the number. Right.
Yeah, just the one on the school-based programming. The most recent evidence about this is in the Surgeon General's report released just a month or so ago, and it does indicate that in school-based programming done in certain ways, in certain contexts, is actually effective. We wouldn't throw that baby out altogether. Having said that, there are many studies, as is pointed out here, that bring into question. The Surgeon General has reviewed that evidence more so than anybody else. I mean, it's an incredible process that they go through. So I would invite you to have a look at that most recent evidence.
Yeah, and you know, it's exciting to read all these comments in the debate. They're not questions to us necessarily. It's just issues in the field. And maybe there's some venue at some point for to pick up on some of these themes and just, if nothing else, just over. With a cup of coffee or some sort of virtual discussion room.
So we have 15 minutes, so we had anticipated this, and even though we did prepare slides on the protection section, we're going to skip over them, and we're going to jump down to our final slides and talk about some of the overall findings that we're having. And then, I don't know if you're able to sort of save those somewhere and look at them, and then maybe we can address some of those in the final discussion, because I think that some of those are probably more general. So if we can just scroll down to...
I'll scroll down so you can see the pretty pictures and stuff, and we're going to, like, we had anticipated not really presenting on protection due to the time. We have about 15 minutes. As I go through really quickly, I could maybe just do a couple of highlights. Right, but indoor smoking is an issue in the province. We do need more surveillance data on this. This data is from a couple of years ago, like that. There is still smoking in patios. Surprisingly, there's quite substantial smoking at home, 12% in 2009 amongst youth, 12 to 19. In cars, again, 11%. It would be interesting to look at more recent data on this when it becomes available. And same data, but just some trend data. We do see some trends of it's moved down for 12 to 19 quite substantially, which does kind of maybe speak to the legislation in the province, but still at 10 or 11%. And we have a number of paths for protection. Again, we're going to leave it at that. We're not really going to get into it. Here's just maybe a summary. Generally some good news. We've done a lot of work in protection over the years. Public support is high. But workplace exposure is high. Restaurant and bar is low in terms of exposure, but patio is quite high as well. So there's still more work to be done in general for protection, but we'll leave it at that for now. There's an opportunity here to have kind of larger discussion that folks want to have. I would suggest for the people that are asking the questions that they be very succinct and maybe move away from the debate to the extent that they want to ask us questions. If they want to carry on the debate, by all means, go ahead. So I'll let Rob speak here.
Yeah, thanks. Just wanted to reiterate, this is the same slide that we had up front, but just to a reminder that these are the overall gaps that we point out in this strategy, and we would encourage people out there to try to work on these yourselves and to advocate for them to be better addressed at the provincial level. As I mentioned in my introduction, we feel that we've made good inroads into providing a sense of the extent to which the strategy is succeeding and where the gaps still are. We're not completely satisfied with what we've produced, and we're ever striving to improve it and to provide even better pictures that will be more helpful to people in deciding what to do and how to do and how much of things to do. So as mentioned, we will be collecting more information about local interventions and their effects, And it's not that we're going to be doing all of the work, but we need to find a way to roll up whatever evaluative information is being produced so that it gets taken into account in the evaluation of the strategy. We want to do some modeling, and we've made good progress in the past year and landed on actually adapting the Sims-Smith model, which will allow us in the coming year to provide some more mathematically derived measures of the effects of different components and how they interact. So it is a model, so it's built on a lot of assumptions, but what we're counting on is that together with the kinds of stories and other evaluative information that we are collecting anywhere is actually going to provide us with a much more sophisticated view of what's happening. This will also help us understand what might happen when new components are introduced, and it will also help us to warn what might happen if existing components would be removed, which we hope never happens. Something we've been working on doing for our planning to do for quite some time is to incorporate in the strategy evaluation report a sense of what are the health effects and what are the changes in the health effects that happen as a result of the changes in prevalence. And the modeling is going to help us do that. We've also been working with our colleagues at CAMH, Jürgen Riem, who does a cost study on tobacco and other substances, to develop a system whereby we can actually plug in some numbers on an annual basis and incorporate them into the strategy evaluation report. We think that it's important for us to understand how these things change as prevalence changes and cessation changes and initiation changes. But we also think that would be a very good advocacy tool for people to use in promoting further work. We started in the past year to do some cost-effectiveness analysis, and actually we're planning in this coming year to work closely with the providers of, in this year, cessation services to do some good comparative cost-effectiveness work. And it's important to get that cost element into the picture of the strategy evaluation report because we have to know not only what the effects of each component are, but also what is the relative cost? I mentioned one earlier on, the social marketing is costly, but is likely to have tremendous impact. So these are things we need to The ministry is working on improved performance measurement. We're supporting the conceptual work on that, and that's something that I think the ministry will be in touch with. Maybe or maybe not together with us moving forward. What we don't want is the PIMS experience to be repeated, and we've warned against that, so stay tuned. Finally, improved KE's knowledge exchange. I think this webinar has strengthened my purpose even more and my resolve to do more of this. I mean, the little bit of interaction we're able to have by seeing the comments and the questions coming across here just screamed to me that we all need to be talking much more than we have been, and it just also drives down the point that sending out the report and putting it on our website is nowhere near enough because it's been there for a while. So many of you may not know that it's been there for a while, and maybe this puts it in front of you, but the verbal and, to the extent possible, face-to-face, but not possible, this whatever technology allows us to do, conversations, I think, are really important.
So in response to the question about the what are the implications of the recent federal cuts in Ontario, I want to focus my response to monitoring and surveillance. That's the focus of this presentation, and Rob may want to add to that, but one of the implications is that the Canadian Tobacco Use Monitoring Survey, population survey, has been reduced in terms of it was an annual survey. It was a fairly intensive survey that had hundreds of questions that track knowledge, attitudes, and behavior on tobacco. It has now moved to every other year, every 2 years. So that has an implication for surveillance, and then to the extent that surveillance information can be used to make evidence decisions, there is kind of less information available to us now than there was prior to the federal cuts. Through the grants and contributions, there was a number of activities funded. For instance, OSHA was funded to look at the marketing of the industry marketing using cigarette packaging. That grant did end, and that contribution did end on March 31st, but it's not going to be going forward in so much as there's no federal money to see what the industry is doing. A number of the NGOs have been funded by grants and contributions, and they did surveil the industry, so to what extent that is going to be carried forward, we don't know. The NGOs, obviously, were able to keep the tobacco on the agenda, both from a programming policy point of view, but also from creating the evidence base as well. So with politicians and stuff, they were able to influence agendas or at least keep tobacco on the agenda. So there's probably going to be less influence to the extent that there's going to be significantly missing bodies in advocating for tobacco control out there. So that is a couple of things.
Sean, it's Michael Perley. I could maybe add a few things to that.
Sure, just to be brief, because we are focused on the...
Well, just that we won't see any more policy change from this government at all. And a particular item is the federal C-32 legislation, which banned flavored products in parallel with the provincial legislation. There's no chance now that bill will be amended or tightened to address how the industry has responded by creating different flavored products. So the bill that was introduced, for example, on Tuesday by Frangelina to ban all flavored products becomes even more important. They're cutting $15 million, which is 35% of their budget. They're cutting 40 jobs from the Controlled Substances and Tobacco Directorate and 80-odd from enforcement personnel nationwide. So we will have no more enforcement people or any people in the field from Health Canada in Ontario. There's a lot more, but it's, I think the way you described it a little bit underestimates the impact to the infrastructure that the feds were providing. I think it'll be worse than you've described based on what we were told by Health Canada in a call last week.
So I don't disagree with you. I was limiting my comments to surveillance.
What
I will add, and this reinforces your point, is that the way we structure our logic models, there's inputs into the system and there's a larger social context. One could translate the federal input into the system of tobacco control in Canada as a $12 or $50 million cut, which then translates into the loss of all those resources. So the way we like to think of tobacco control is negative and positive vectors, pushes and pulls. This is a subtraction from the equation, right, in terms of like whether you're looking at contribution analysis or negative and positive vectors. So, it's taken out of the equation and it's a positive force. So, you need to consider my comments about surveillance in relation to Michael's comments that there's this subtraction from the equation, which is a significant loss.
Yeah, and if anyone wants a list of the G's and C's that are going to be eliminated, or you want notes on the call that we had at Health Canada's request with them last week that had filled us in on what they were doing, just let me know. Just email me directly. I'd be happy to send it to anyone who's interested. And we'll be covering this on our teleconference coming up next week.
Okay, thank you, Michael. I'd just like to say in conclusion that it's been a real pleasure to have some interaction and to listen and to see some of the comments and questions. We are more than happy to converse with you. So if people have specific questions and comments or even general ones that they would like to address to OTRU, then please do send us an email or give us a call. I can be reached at robert.schwartz@utoronto.ca and sean@sean_onnor, with no apostrophe, at camh.net. camh.net. Well, thank you, Erica. Fred, you going to conclude here? Thank you very much, all.
Thank you very much, Rob and Sean, for joining us today. I'll basically end by saying that PTCC offers a variety of programs and services to build capacity of tobacco control practitioners, and we would encourage you to go to the PTCC website for more information about our services, or you can call the 1-800 number that I gave earlier. And please check our website as well for the audio recording of this webinar, and you can follow up with the slide deck. And following this webinar as well, please, you'll be sent an email with a link to a survey about the webinar, and would appreciate if you can fill out this survey. We welcome your feedback on how this webinar has benefited you and how we can improve future webinars. Thank you, everyone who participated in today's online learning experience. Thanks.
Thank you. Please stand by.